Hi, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour. From the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater, and today, as always, we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with the Westfair Business Journal, we have a couple articles. Our first one is written by Peter Katz. It's titled, 3 HV Housing Projects to Get $37.9 Million in State Funding. 3 Hudson Valley housing developments are due to share in $37.9 million in state funding as part of a larger state plan to provide $412 million in bonds and subsidies to expand the housing supply. The goal is to create or preserve nearly 1,100 affordable housing units in the Hudson Valley, New York City, and the Finger Lakes region. The newly announced awards are part of Governor Hochul's $25 billion housing plan that ultimately is expected to create or preserve 100,000 affordable housing units throughout the state, along with 10,000 units where supportive services for vulnerable populations will be available. The overall plan also envisions converting 50,000 homes to be all electric. The financing is allocated through bonds floated by New York State Homes and Community Renewal, or HCR. Benefiting from the financing in Ulster County in the Hudson Valley are 3 properties known as the Ulster Portfolio. They have a total of 212 units that are priced as affordable housing. The Ulster Portfolio consists of the 80-unit Birchwood Village in the city of Kingston, the Birches at Saugerties in the town of Saugerties with 60 apartments, and the 72-unit Chambers Senior Housing in the town of Ulster. The 3 properties will undergo extensive capital improvements and interior renovations, including sustainability improvements. The developer is Beacon Communities, LLC. The company has offices in Albany, Buffalo, New York City, Boston, and Pittsburgh. The company says it has completed construction, financial restructuring, or substantial rehabilitation on over 10,000 apartments, both as sole developer and in partnership with others. Commissioner Ruth Ann Visnoskis said today's $412 million announcement is another significant investment to bring more affordable housing to New York City, the Finger Lakes, and the Hudson Valley. Next, from the Westfair Business Journal, an article written by Georgette Gouveia is titled, 3 Retailers Slated for Yorktown Green. 3 national retailers will move into the defunct Kmart store at the Yorktown Green Shopping Center as part of the Yorktown Town Board's plan to reinvent its retail areas. TJ Maxx, Michaels, and Five Below, which will fill the empty big box store at 335 Downing Drive, are expected to continue the revitalization of the shopping center, which began in 2022 when Uncle Giuseppe's Marketplace moved into a former supermarket space that had been vacant for 10 years. The town board has made every effort to facilitate a renaissance for this vital property in the center of Yorktown Heights Business District, and we will soon see the results of our work, said Deputy Supervisor Ed Lachterman, adding, we will continue our economic development work by focusing on other local shopping centers that require reimagination. Indeed, Yorktown Green is not the only retail center in the municipality expecting new store openings. A Mr. Softy and Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs, two of my favorites, have opened in the former Subway space at 1992 Commerce Street, while a Crumble Cookies Bakery is preparing to open near the BJ's Wholesale Club on Compound Road. We'll now move to this week's Hartford Business Journal. Our first article, written by Michael Puffer, is titled, 2 Downtown Waterbury Mixed-Use Apartment Buildings Sell for $3.1 Million. a New York couple that was an early investor in downtown Waterbury market rate housing recently sold two mixed-use apartment buildings with a combined 30 units for $3.1 million. In a sale recorded April 2nd, Parag and Rupa Mehta sold a 12-unit apartment building at 63 Bank Street and an 18-unit building at 68 to 70 Bank Street, both in Waterbury, to a limited liability company headed by Amilcar Perez. Both buildings date back to around 1890, according to assessor records, but had seen the upper floors renovated into market-rate apartments over the past decade or so. The building at 63 Bank Street hosts the Green Deli and Convenience on its first floor. The space at 68 to 70 Bank Street is fitted out for restaurant use but has struggled to find a permanent tenant for years and is currently vacant. Perez, another New York-based investor, has been building a portfolio of Waterbury rental properties totaling about 100 units since 2017. These include a mix of smaller 3- and 6-family units up to an 18-unit building he purchased in the city's Brooklyn neighborhood for $1.8 million in late 2023. Perez said he bought the Mehta buildings to get into more upscale housing. He intends to continue the building's focus on a tenant base of young professionals. He said he will update some units with new countertops, flooring, and more. Waterbury officials have long sought to encourage market-rate housing in the city's downtown, and the Mehtas were among the first to answer that call. They paid $346,640 for the four-story, 15,200-square-foot building at 68 to 70 Bank Street in 2007 and performed a complete gut rehab of the building. In 2009, they paid $415,000 for the 7-story Apothecary Hall building at 63 Bank Street. The iconic 860-square-foot building, shaped like a wedge, is nestled between South Main and Bank Streets. The city has invested tens of millions of dollars over the past decade on economic development projects meant to revive its downtown with a heavy focus around Bank Street. This includes securing $7.7 million state grant to assist a $15 million renovation of the former Howland Hughes department store on Bank Street, renovation of the town green around the corner, and a rebuild of nearby East Main Street. Waterbury Mayor Paul Penaruski Jr. on Wednesday said he was happy to see the sale go through and looked forward to engaging with the new owner. His interest in Waterbury, especially downtown, shows that Waterbury remains an active opportunity for investors who can see its potential, Penaruski said. Albin Dzhukov, Ilar Dzhukov, and Nick Selka, sorry for the pronunciation, of Brookfield-based Lakeshore Realty brokered the deal for both sides. Albin Dzhukov, Lakeshore's senior vice president, said the property was brokered off-market to active investors in the Waterbury area. Mehta said the buildings are LEED certified and spacious. The Mehtas got the price they wanted and Perez got a solid deal. I think it's a tremendous location, Dzhukov said. Dzhukov says he advises investors to look at Waterbury, which he believes offers great potential for increasing values. Next up, an article written by Andrew Larson titled Pratt & Whitney to invest $20 million in a Florida expansion as it pursues a major new office in East Hartford. While aerospace manufacturer Pratt & Whitney plans a major new office in East Hartford, it's also continuing to grow its investment in Florida. On Wednesday, the East Hartford-based defense contractor announced it will invest $20 million to expand a key plant in West Palm Beach, Florida. The expansion will allow Pratt & Whitney to increase the capacity of its West Palm Beach Engine Center, a maintenance, repair, and overhaul facility for its GTF engine, by 40% by the second half of 2025. The news comes as Pratt & Whitney seeks local zoning approvals to build a new 313,000-square-foot office building on its East Hartford campus. The new building is part of a longer-term renovation to its headquarters. In Florida, the company said, it will increase its workforce by 25% over the next year and will add new equipment to support the capacity increase. The expansion at West Palm Beach is the latest example of our global investment to support the GTF fleet, said Kevin Kirkpatrick, Vice President of Global Aftermarket Operations at Pratt & Whitney. We remain steadfast in our commitment to support customers and maintain their trust as we carry out the GTF fleet management plan, he added. Pratt & Whitney is a subsidiary of RTX Corporation based in Arlington, Virginia. It has more than 185,000 employees across the world and had sales of $69 billion in 2023. RTX was formerly known as Raytheon Technologies Corporation, which formed in 2020 following the $135 billion merger of Farmington-based United Technologies Corporation and a defense contractor Raytheon Company, which was based in Massachusetts at the time. The new company initially formed its headquarters in Waltham, Massachusetts, but relocated to Arlington in 2022. Next up from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by David Krzyzewski, is titled, 7 Brew Gets OK to Build First New England Franchise in Wallingford. While raising concerns about traffic and employee safety, the Wallingford Planning and Zoning Commission approved a plan Monday night for New England's first 7 Brew drive-through coffee shop. The special permit application was approved by a 4-to-1 vote following a public hearing. The new facility will be constructed at 905 North Colony Road, also known as Route 5. The site is currently occupied by the Captain C's restaurant, which has lost its lease. Captain C's owner, Fannie Minos, said on Wednesday that the restaurant will close after Mother's Day on May 12th. The restaurant, known for its seafood, has been at that location for 15 years. Manos said she is still searching for a new location, but has not yet found anything suitable. During Monday's public hearing, 7 Brew representative Wade Harden and Marcus Podock, a North Haven-based civil engineer, represented applicants Rohan Kapoor and Manraj Parmar of Drive Through Brew, LLC, and presented the application to the commission. Potok said the existing building will be demolished and the pavement will be completely resurfaced. A modular building for the drive-through shop will then be brought to the site and installed. He stated that the business, which was founded in Arkansas in 2017 and now has more than 200 locations across the United States, is strictly a drive-through beverage operation with no indoor or outdoor seating and no food prepared or served. According to its presentation, cars will queue up in 2 lanes and customers will have orders taken by runners with electronic tablets. Drinks, which include hot and cold coffee, tea, and energy drinks, will be delivered by other staff at the end of the line. Just 13 parking spaces will be created, but will be for use only by 7 Brew staff, he said. Commission member Jim Cohan was concerned about employee safety since the drive-through lanes are separated only by stripes on the pavement and not physical barriers. Members also raised concerns about the effect of cold or wet weather on employees, but were given assurances that Seven Brew has other locations in cold weather areas and provides shelter and heat for their employees. Members also expressed concern that Route 5 often has heavy traffic and that the lot's location is not near a traffic light, which could make left turns out of the property difficult. After lengthy discussion, the applicants agreed to include an access easement at the rear of the property that, if needed, could connect it with the car wash next door to the south to allow excess vehicles another exit. Cohan was the sole member to vote against approving the special permit, citing his concerns over employee safety. Moving back into the Hartford Business Journal for this week, an article written by Michael Puffer is titled "Manufacturer Acquired in 2021 Sells Plainville Headquartered Building for $7.45 million." Plainville-based switches and circuit breakers manufacturer Carling Technologies Incorporated recently sold its 129,506-square-foot manufacturing building on 25.76 acres for $7.45 million. Carling sold the building at 60 Johnson Avenue to Fifth Continental Properties, a company registered in Wyoming, according to a deed recorded on March 25th. Town assessing records list Fifth Continental Properties' address as a post office box in Thomaston. That same post office box is the mailing address listed in state business records for Element 119, a maker of ceramic composite nano coating for automotive, aerospace, and marine applications with a production facility in Thomaston and offices in Cheshire. Attempts to reach representatives of Carling and Element 119 were unsuccessful. Carling Technologies was purchased in 2021 by Chicago electronics manufacturer Little Fuse Incorporated for $315 million in cash. At the time of that deal, Carling, which manufactures switches, controls, circuit breakers, and power distribution units for the commercial vehicle, marine, telecommunications, and data communications markets, said it had approximately 2,800 employees worldwide, with its headquarters in Plainville and sites in Florida, Texas, Mexico, England, Hong Kong, and China. The company said it had annualized sales of about $170 million. The listing brokers of the property sale included Chris Duclos, Catherine Frazier, and Stephanie Romano Shaw of Century Commercial. Nicholas Maurizio, president of Colliers International in Hartford and New Haven, represented the buyer. Next, an article written by David Krzyzewski titled "New Haven-based Arvinas Signs Licensing Deal with Novartis Worth Up to $1 Billion." New Haven-based biotech Arvinas Incorporated has signed a licensing agreement with Swiss drug maker Novartis AG that could be worth up to $1.01 billion, the company announced on Thursday. Arvinas, a clinical stage company, is working on treatments for prostate and breast cancer. It has been focused on creating drugs that harness the body's natural protein disposal system to remove disease-causing proteins. Under terms of the agreement, Arvinas will receive a $150 million upfront payment to license ARV-766, its second-generation drug to treat prostate cancer. The deal also includes an asset purchase agreement to sell Arvinas' preclinical ARV-7 program to Novartis. Terms of the agreement also require Novartis to be responsible for worldwide clinical development and commercialization of ARV-766, and the Swiss company will have all research, development, manufacturing, and commercialization rights for the preclinical ARV-7 program, the company said. Under the license agreement, Arvinas is eligible to receive additional development, regulatory, and commercial payments of up to $1.01 billion, as well as tiered royalties for ARV-766, it said. The agreement is subject to certain regulatory approvals, including the expiration or termination of the waiting period under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Antitrust Improvements Act of 1976. We believe the expertise and scale of Novartis will broaden the development of ARV-766 and its potential to be a first and best-in-class treatment for patients with prostate cancer, said John Houston, Arvinas' chairman, president, and CEO. Goldman Sachs & Company, LLC, is acting as the exclusive financial advisor to Arvinas. Arvinas also has an ongoing collaboration with Pfizer to develop and commercialize vepdegestrant, ARV-471, a breast cancer drug candidate in Phase 3 clinical trials. Next, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini titled, Former Cooper Atkins Plant in Middlefield Sold for $1.4 Million. The former Cooper Atkins manufacturing plant in Middlefield has been sold to a real estate investment firm that will bring in a new tenant for light industrial work. The property at 33 Reeds Gap Road was bought by Yalesville Properties and Wallingford-based RGR Investments, LLC, with principals Jonathan Gavin and Harley James from the Cooper Atkins Company for $1.4 million in a deal recorded March 25th. James said the deal was an investment purchase and the space will be leased to a single tenant in the light manufacturing and assembly field that will occupy the building starting May 1st. He declined to name the tenant. The Cooper Atkins Company, established in 1885, makes thermometers and other temperature gauging tools. It was acquired by St. Louis-based industrial manufacturer Emerson Commercial and Residential Solutions in 2018, when 150 employees worked at the Middlefield plant. In November 2022, the company announced the closure of the Middlefield plant and the layoff of 68 employees. The sellers were represented by Daniel G. Barber of Northeast Property Group. The building dates back to 1964 and features more than 39,500 square feet of space on 8 acres near the Lyman Orchards Fruit Farms and Golf Center. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson is titled, 11 Contractor Rental Units Approved on Route 6 in Farmington. The Farmington Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday approved a developer's plan to construct 4 buildings on Route 6 that will provide rental office space and storage units tailored for trade-focused businesses. The property is located at 8774 Scott Swamp Road, next to Jilly Bean's Farm Stand and diagonally across from Kineticare's headquarters. The property currently houses an abandoned State Department of Transportation salt storage shed, which would be demolished. The owner, Dan Pizzoferrato, purchased the property from the DOT for $276,000 in June of 2023. Pizzoferrato's business, 8774 Scott Swamp LLC, received approval for the site plan and a special permit, which includes excavation of a ledge on the adjacent farm property and a rock crushing operation to create an impervious surface for the contractor yard. Commissioners said they favored redevelopment of the parcel, calling the abandoned shed an eyesore. The total project investment is expected to be about $2.4 million, according to Pizzoferrato. The plans show four buildings, 9,600 square feet, 2,700 square feet, 5,000 square feet, and 4,800 square feet, with a total of 11 rental units. There is also a paved parking lot. Each unit will have an office, bathroom, and storage space. No material will be stored outside. The hours of operation are expected to be 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. The complex will have a one-way paved entrance driveway on the east side of the property and a one-way exit with a stop sign, including separate lanes for right and left turns on the west side. The project also required DOT approval because Scott Swamp Road, or Route 6, is a state road. Pizzoferrato said the units are aimed at helping small businesses in the fields of HVAC, electrical, and plumbing to start operations in affordable, modern, and efficient spaces. Pizzoferrato told the Economic Development Commission in April that he has completed three similar projects in Newington, which are successful due to high demand for contractor rental units. Next, an article written by Andrew Larson titled "Students Partner with Businesses for Quantum Hackathon in New Haven." Hundreds of students from across the world will converge in New Haven this weekend for the 2024 Quantum Hackathon, where they will develop and test code on quantum hardware in an effort to solve real-world business problems. Aspiring software developers, physicists, electrical engineers, and others with an interest in quantum science will stay overnight at the Yale Quantum Institute and work for 24 hours. They will seek to master challenges developed by Amazon Web Services, Google's Sandbox AQ, IBM Quantum, Quantinium, the Hartford, Capgemini, Xanadu, Covalent, Yale Ventures, and UConn Research. The inaugural hackathon, known as Y Quantum 2024, was organized by Yale Undergraduate Quantum Computing Group in partnership with Quantum CT and Yale Quantum Institute. The event is Saturday and Sunday, which is World Quantum Day, at 17 Hillhouse Avenue. Registration has closed, but visitors may attend. The hackathon will feature keynote speakers, workshops, problem identification, hacking, and mentoring on Saturday, and novel pitches and judging on Sunday, with a celebration for World Quantum Day. To a geek like me, that sounds interesting. Next up, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson titled "Haven Hot Chicken to Open a Newington Location on Saturday." So many hot chicken places. New Haven-based Haven Hot Chicken announced that it will open a new location in Newington on Saturday. The fast-growing chain's seventh location is at 12 Fenn Road and is one of at least three new restaurants expected to open this year. The others will be at 907 Post Road in Fairfield and at the Quarry Walk Shopping Center in Oxford. Haven Hot Chicken, founded in 2020, is known for its Nashville-style chicken and its vegetarian not chicken, along with several other offerings. Haven Hot Chicken also has locations in Middletown, New Haven, Orange, Norwalk, New Haven, and stores. Next, an article written by David Krzyzewski titled "A Year After Approving It, Wallingford Planning and Zoning Denies a Zone Change for a Restaurant." Just over a year after it unanimously granted approval, the Wallingford Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday denied a zone change application for a controversial restaurant. The commission, continuing a public hearing that opened in January, was reconsidering a zone change application from Lost and Found Ventures LLC for a parcel at the corner of Mansion Road and South Turnpike Road, less than a mile south of the Oakdale Theater. An unoccupied house and shed exist on the property. The applicant, Joe Flamini, and his partners have proposed developing a restaurant and food truck park on the property, which angered abutting residential property owners. The proposal received approval for a permit from the Inland Wetlands and Watercourses Commission in October. As explained by the applicant's attorney, Dennis Senavia of Meriden, Flamini in 2021 agreed to buy two parcels, 8 and 10 Mansion Road, on the condition that a zone change would be approved for 10 Mansion Road, which is also known as 0 South Turnpike Road. That parcel is primarily zoned R18, a single-family residential zone, with the rest zoned DD40, a commercial zone that allows for a variety of uses that include restaurants and retail shops. Senaviva said there are two compelling reasons to approve a zone change to make the entire property DD40, saying it would allow a better site for development and remove the complications of dealing with two mutually exclusive uses. The P&Z had unanimously approved the application in March of 23, but a town filing error voided that decision, Senaviva said. He told the commission that the town's corporation council had determined that the failure of the town to file a copy of the zoning map and a zoning amendment with the town clerk made that particular zone change void. Following the commission's unanimous decision last year, abutting property owners and residents on Mansion Road protested the proposed restaurant, saying it will disrupt their neighborhood, increase traffic, hurt their property values, and harm the environment. Residents of the Heritage Woods condominium complex, located just up Mansion Road from the parcel, said they were never notified of the original public hearing on the zone change application. We'll now move to the Thursday, April 11th, New York Times business section, starting off with the Business Roundup Dealbook newsletter. The first article in the newsletter, the odds for a summertime rate cut are dwindling. And again, all these stories are written by the entire business staff. What inflation means for the Fed and Biden. U.S. inflation jitters are being felt around the world this morning after the latest Consumer Price Index report showed inflation ticked up for a third straight month. The dollar spiked overnight and traders slashed their bets on when, or whether, the Fed would cut interest rates this year. Such uncertainty could last for months and complicate President Biden's bid for a second term. Traders this morning were pricing in less than 2 rate cuts for 2024, down from more than 6 at the start of the year, possibly starting in July. But even that's looking tenuous after headline CPI hit 3.5% in March. The growing view on Wall Street is that inflation will need to get closer to the Fed's 2% target before the central bank makes a move. Some are going even further. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and a critic of the Fed's handling of inflation, told Bloomberg that a rate increase cannot be ruled out. The next inflation data comes out today at 8:30 a.m. Eastern when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases the Producer Price Index, a key indicator for businesses. Investors will also be tuning into today's European Central Bank News Conference. That big question, will the ECB cut before the Fed or will the U.S. inflation woes muzzle those calls? Politics could muddle the Fed's timing. The Fed is an independent body, but perceptions that it may lean either right or left tend to surface in election years. Donald Trump has already voiced his concern about possible Fed cuts this year. Rate reductions later this year may be complicated by policymakers seeking to avoid the appearance of taking positions on the presidential election campaign, which revs into high gear this summer. Jose Torres, an economist at Interactive Brokers, wrote in a client note yesterday. Deutsche Bank economists agree, saying the window for rate cuts could close this year if the inflation data doesn't cool by July. The fallout from the CPI could linger. Higher for longer fears are rattling the bond market. Investors dumped U.S. sovereign debt yesterday, pushing the yield on the 10-year note to a five-month high. That could spell bad news for households as the rates on mortgages and other types of loans tend to edge higher as yields on 10-year treasuries climb. Biden's poll ratings have sagged as voters zero in on the higher cost of living, even though the U.S. economy has grown faster than that of many comparable countries. Economists are increasingly wondering if the United States is heading for a no-landing scenario of persistently high inflation that ties the Fed's hands on rates. Thomas Barkin, the Richmond Fed president, summed up the tough spot policymakers were in, saying, "We need to be humble," he said yesterday. The next thing to watch, corporate profits. Stocks rallied last quarter, thanks in part to stronger-than-expected corporate profits and hopes for imminent rate cuts. Cuts are in limbo, but a new earnings season kicks off with Wall Street heavyweights J.P. Morgan Chase, BlackRock, and Wells Fargo reporting results tomorrow on Friday. Three short articles with what's happening in the business world. First up, the TikTok divestiture deadline could be extended. Maria Cantwell, the Washington State Democrat and Senate Commerce Committee Chair, said she was open to giving ByteDance more time to sell the video platform. A House bill that overwhelmingly passed in March would force TikTok to split from the Chinese company within 6 months or be banned from American app stores. Next, Elon Musk to visit India amid reports he could build a new Tesla factory. Musk will meet with Narendra Modi, India's prime minister, during the trip this month and will announce plans to build a new factory to make electric vehicles, Reuters reports. With Tesla sales growth slowing, Musk is looking to expand into new markets. And President Biden warns of an Iranian attack on Israeli assets. Biden said Iran was threatening a significant attack in response to an Israeli missile strike last week on Iran's embassy in Damascus that killed top military commanders. The president has reiterated his support for Israel even as he has increased his criticism of its tactics in the war against Hamas. Next article from the Business Roundup, Amazon doubles down on artificial intelligence. Amazon has been on a tear in recent months. Its stock is up more than 80% in the past year, and the tech giant is edging toward a market capitalization of $2 trillion on the back of its bets on artificial intelligence. Andy Jassy's annual letter to Amazon shareholders has just been published, and the CEO is doubling down on AI. Amazon sees generative AI powering future breakthroughs. Jassy said the tech being used to power chatbots like ChatGPT will be key to how the company develops and builds new businesses. After a late start in AI, Amazon has stepped up its spending. It backed the AI startup Anthropic to the tune of $4 billion, its biggest venture capital investment, and is building its own models that it hopes will be an emerging business line. The company plans to do more in building AI chips. NVIDIA dominates the sector, but companies are looking for more options. Amazon has already built two chips that are being used by Anthropic, Airbnb, Snap, and others. Jassy also sees strong potential for Amazon SageMaker, a service that helps companies organize their data so that it's AI-ready. Amazon's dominant cloud business gives it an edge. Jassy says Amazon Web Services customers are increasingly turning to the computing platform to build and scale their AI applications. And the company is building AI apps across all of its businesses while getting development partners to build on top of its technology. Prime Video could be a profit machine. Amazon's streaming platform has grown into a behemoth with more than 200 million monthly viewers and recently introduced advertising. Jassy is confident about the unit's prospects, pointing to exclusive content like Thursday Night Football and high customer engagement. Could it be spun out? Space could be the next frontier. Jassy said the company achieved a big milestone for Project Kuiper, its satellite internet business, when it launched two prototypes into space to provide broadband access in remote areas. The low Earth satellite business is dominated by Elon Musk's Starlink, but Amazon sees room for growth. Its first production satellites are set for launch later this year. Next article in the roundup, Paramount's Skydance deal hits another bump. One more Paramount shareholder is going public with concerns about the media group's talks to merge with the film studio Skydance, DealBook's Lauren Hirsch is first to report. Ariel Investments, which had a 1.8% stake in Paramount at the end of last year, is the biggest shareholder to join the growing list of investors that are openly pushing for a rethink. Here's a recap of the Paramount Skydance negotiations. Sherry Redstone's holding company, National Amusements, controls Paramount via a super voting class of stock. Skydance, run by tech scion David Ellison, has provisionally agreed to buy National Amusements. Paramount would then merge with Skydance in a deal that would value the studio at about $5 billion and would allow Redstone to cash out at a premium while other shareholders get diluted shares in a new company. Ariel wants Paramount to consider a higher offer from Apollo Global Management. Ariel, an asset manager founded by the value investor John Rogers, says Paramount should look at a $26 billion proposal from Apollo, a private equity giant, despite concerns on financing. Any merger talks that forego competitive bidding in favor of an exclusive discussion with a single buyer, particularly where the reported control premium differentiates the financial position of a single shareholder over all other shareholders, an Ariel spokeswoman said, is averse to the fair market value of a company. Ariel is also worried about potential board changes at Paramount. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that four directors will leave. They are Don Ostroff, a former Spotify executive, Nicole Seligman, a former general counsel at Sony, the investment banker Frederick Turrell, and Rob Kleiger, Redstone's lawyer. Seligman, Ostroff, and Turrell are also members of a special committee of independent directors tasked with finding the best deal for the company. The changes may compromise the board's ability to act on behalf of all shareholders, the Ariel spokeswoman said. Shares in Paramount closed 4% lower yesterday. Next article, which CEOs got invites to last night's state dinner? Some of the biggest figures in American and Japanese business joined President Biden and Prime Minister Fumio Kishida at the White House last night for a state dinner to celebrate the deepening of ties between the two trading allies. The U.S. executives included J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon, Apple's Tim Cook, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, BlackRock's Larry Fink, and John Gray of Blackstone. They adeptly ducked questions about whether their appearance signaled their support for Biden's re-election. But the White House probably only invited CEOs seen as supportive, and it was hard to avoid the mixing of business, politics, and diplomacy. One other interesting name on the guest list, David McCall, president of United Steelworkers. The union has come out against Nippon Steel's $14 billion bid for U.S. Steel. Biden has signaled he's against it too, and the union has endorsed him. From the New York Times, an article written by Mike Ives titled, U.S. Postal Service Proposes Raising Stamp Prices Again. The United States Postal Service on Tuesday proposed an overall increase of nearly 8% on the price of postage, the latest in a series of stamp hikes over the past 3 years. The new prices would take effect in July, pending approval from an independent regulatory commission. Among other changes, a forever stamp would cost 73 cents instead of 68 cents, and the price of a domestic postcard would rise to 56 cents from 53 cents. The proposed changes, like several others since 2021, are part of the service's 10-year plan to raise prices and slow some deliveries, among other measures, to try to recoup $160 billion in projected losses over a decade. The Postal Service has faced financial issues for years because, for years, it was required to fund retiree health care benefits for its employees in advance. It's also facing headwinds like other postal services globally as fewer people send mail. Its operations are generally not funded by tax revenues. The price hikes proposed on Tuesday would need to be approved by the Postal Regulatory Commission, an independent agency in Washington that oversees the Postal Service. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Stanley Reed. It's titled, Why Oil Prices Have Been Rising Recently. Oil prices have climbed in recent weeks, spurred by concerns over supplies and geopolitical risks, including wars in Ukraine and the Middle East. Analysts say the momentum could carry prices higher. The price of a barrel of Brent crude oil, the international benchmark, has risen more than 20% since mid-December. It has jumped more than 10% over the past month alone to around $90 a barrel. The sentiment is really bullish, said Victor Katona, an analyst at Kepler, a commodities research firm. Rising oil prices could make efforts by central banks to reduce inflation more challenging. In the United States, higher gasoline prices during the summer driving season would also be unwelcome for the Biden administration, which faces a difficult election in November. The average price at the pump has risen about 50 cents per gallon since early January to around $3.70, according to the Energy Information Administration. Market watchers note that a short-term retreat in prices after such a rapid rise is also possible. The oil price also remains below the peaks reached in 2022 when prices jumped well above $100 a barrel. In 2023, strong growth in crude output from the United States, the world's largest oil producer, and other countries outside the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, helped reassure markets that there would be enough oil to slack demand. Prices remained subdued for much of the year, despite the threats posed by geopolitical tensions. Initially, markets largely shrugged off the risks posed by the conflict between Israel and Hamas. But 2024 looks like a very different year. Demand has been stronger than some analysts expected, and a series of potentially disruptive events, along with production cuts by Saudi Arabia and its allies, have raised worries of a potential supply squeeze. The most unsettling development was the killing of a group of Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders in an airstrike in Damascus, Syria on April 1st. Iran pledged to retaliate, raising fears that its actions could pull key exporters in the Persian Gulf into the conflict, which began with the Hamas attack on Israel in October. That's always been the fear since October 7th, the direct confrontation between Iran, the U.S., and Israel, said Jim Burkhardt, vice president and head of research for oil markets, energy, and mobility at S&P Global Commodity Insights. The Middle East conflict has had little effect on oil supplies so far, Mr. Burkhardt said, but markets will be on edge until they see how the face-off between Israel and Iran plays out. The continuing effort by the group of oil producers known as OPEC Plus to limit oil supplies adds to the edginess. Largely orchestrated by Saudi Arabia's oil minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, these production trims are removing around 5 million barrels a day, or potentially around 5% of the supply from the market. There is always skepticism about whether OPEC will stick to its commitments, but it is dawning on the markets that these cuts may not be relaxed anytime soon unless prices rise substantially. We don't expect a formal increase out of OPEC Plus unless prices are above $100 a barrel, Mr. Burkhardt said. Instead, the Saudi-led group has focused on signaling its resolve. In March, several members announced the extension of production cuts through June. To drive the point home, OPEC Plus said in a news release on April 1st that two of its members, Iraq and Kazakhstan, had agreed to compensate for overproduction. The Middle East is not the only potential source of disruption for oil markets. Russia has been making slow gains in its war with Ukraine, while Kyiv has figured out how to use drones and missiles to inflict significant damage on Russian oil infrastructure, at least temporarily reducing Russia's ability to produce products like diesel and gasoline. Ukraine's aim is apparently to try to reduce the revenue Russia has available to fund the war, but the impact could be felt in world petroleum markets. Knocking out plants tightens up the global trade in energy products, said David Fife, chief economist at Argus Media, a commodities research firm, adding that is helping juice up crude oil prices as well. Analysts say a further lift may come in the summer when seasonal demand is typically high as people take to cars and planes for vacation trips. Tensions would come to a head in early June when the ministers from OPEC Plus plan to gather in Vienna to decide how much oil to put into the market. Some members of the group may want to see an increase in production, but the Saudis are likely to resist, analysts say. Richard Bronze, the head of Energy Aspects, a research firm, said the Saudis are setting their policy on what they think is right for the oil market and their budget, and there's very little leverage that Washington has at present to get them to consider loosening. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Jenny Gross. It's titled, Internet Traffic Dipped as Viewers Took in the Eclipse. As the moon blocked the view of the sun across parts of Mexico, the United States, and Canada on Monday, the celestial event managed another magnificent feat. It got people offline. According to Cloudflare, a cloud computing service used by about 20% of websites globally, internet traffic dipped along the path of totality as spellbound viewers took a break from their phones and computers to catch a glimpse of the real-life spectacle. The places with the most dramatic views saw the biggest dips in traffic compared with the previous week. In Vermont, Arkansas, Indiana, Maine, New Hampshire, and Ohio, states that were in the path of totality, meaning the moon completely blocked out the sun, internet traffic dropped by 40 to 60% around the time of the eclipse, Cloudflare said. States that had partial views also saw drops in internet activity, but to a much lesser extent. At 3:25 p.m. Eastern Time, internet traffic in New York dropped by 29% compared with the previous week, Cloudflare found. The path of totality made up a roughly 110-mile-wide belt that stretched from Mazatlan, Mexico to Montreal. In the Mexican state of Durango, which was in the eclipse zone, internet traffic measured by Cloudflare dipped 57% compared with the previous week, while farther south in Mexico City, traffic was down 22%. The duration of the eclipse's totality varied by location, with some places experiencing it for more than 4 minutes, while for others it was just 1 to 2 minutes. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Rebecca Carballo is titled, "Why Are Gold Bar Sales Surging at Costco?" Alongside its $1.50 hot dog and soda combo, gallon tubs of mayonnaise, and value packs of socks, Costco, the warehouse retailer, has been selling gold bars since October. Now, retail analysts say Costco is selling up to $200 million worth of gold and silver each month, according to an analysis from Wells Fargo. Online forums and Reddit threads have cropped up where customers give each other advice on how to purchase the bars before they sell out. "I've gotten a couple of calls that people have seen online that we've been selling 1 ounce gold bars, yes, but when we load them on the site, they're typically gone within a few hours," Richard Galanti, executive vice president and chief financial officer, said in an earnings call in September. Costco is now selling 1 ounce 24-karat gold bars, according to its online store. The bars can be purchased only by members, and the price varies based on market rates. As of Thursday, the bars were sold out for members online, but the Wall Street Journal reported that shoppers purchased them for around $2,000 in December. Costco has also been selling silver coins, advertised at 99.9% pure silver, since January, according to an analyst report from Wells Fargo. The precious metal has set a series of records as it surged to $2,350 per troy ounce, up roughly $300 since the start of March. Buying gold becomes more common in times of economic turmoil. Although the U.S. economic outlook has improved and inflation has slowed until recently, it remains higher than the targets from the Federal Reserve, says Sadiq Adatia, the chief investment officer for BMO Global Asset Management. And on Wednesday, a key inflation rate was revealed to be stronger than expected. Investors have said they were puzzled about the rally. Geopolitical concerns could also be a factor in an increasing interest in gold, Mr. Adashia said. There has been more interest in gold since Ukraine's currency collapsed after Russia's invasion, he said. For those looking to purchase gold for the first time, Costco provides familiarity and ease, Mr. Adashia said. "They make it convenient," he said. "People can physically go in and pick it up, and that's it, versus opening up an account and buying gold shares." So how much is Costco profiting from this? Probably not too much. Given its pricing and shipping costs, it's likely a very low profit business at best, analysts with Wells Fargo wrote in a note to clients on Tuesday. The company sold over $100 million of gold during its first quarter, or the three-month period ending on September 30th last year, Mr. Galanti said on a December earnings call. However, those sales have likely grown since then and may now be running at $100 to $200 million per month, which could increase its sales figures by 1%. Well, you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour from the Bear Cave. I'm Barry Slater. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. and thank you for letting me give you all the business.